UK Wine Show, show number 164. Washington Wines with Glenn Yaffa and Mike Coveney. G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show. It's the 10th of July 2009 and my name's Chris Scott. Well, the weather this week has been very stormy with random downpours all week, and it makes us worry a wee bit about what's going to happen in the Ashes cricket test. Although all the rain is really good for the garden, and with my tayberry bush about to give up its first flush of beautiful berries. I was quite surprised with the flavour actually. It's quite a floral flavour with rose petals. It reminds me a bit like Gewurz Traminer, but not too pungent, and quite a pleasant mix of red berry fruits. How's that for a berry tasting note? If you're not sure what tayberry is, it's a cross between a raspberry and a blackberry, by the way. Let's get on to the wine show, that's enough berry talk. On this week's show, we're finishing up looking at the other US wine regions, this time finishing off with the number two wine region in the US, Washington State. With its vast array of varieties and climates, it's a region lacking a central core identity. Either way, it still manages to make some fantastic wines, and we're going to find out about that later on in the show. In the spotlight, we review Tom Stevenson's wine report, and this week's mystery wine region is a hilltop town in France. Historically, it was a red wine region until the middle of the 20th century, and it produced red and white wines from the Chasselas grape. It was not until white Sauvignon Blanc wines were introduced into Parisian bistros that it began to climb to fame. The climate here is continental, but a river to the east and forest to the west help moderate the low temperatures. How's that? Got any ideas? I'll give you more clues after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. A new report by Mintel shows that wine consumption is falling in the UK, and analysts put it down to public concern over binge drinking and the rises in alcohol duty. The UK is the world's biggest importer of wine, but with sales and consumption rates down, Mintel say producers need to target a younger audience of 25 to 34-year-olds to ensure future growth. Meanwhile, Majestic Wine is experiencing a 20% decline in sales at its Wine and Beer World stores in Calais and Cherbourg as demand for booze cruises slumps. Majestic blame the weak pound against the euro, which is putting a stop to Brits travelling to France to stock up on cheap wine and avoid the high UK duty on alcohol. They have closed the distribution depot in Calais and brought 12 staff back to work in the UK.
Majestic's dream run of improved company performance ended this year. It's a shame that the new CEO Steve Lewis has had a hard start to his reign, but with consumption levels starting to fall, it's hard for big companies to fly against the wind, especially when they supply a significant part of the corporate market, who have been battering down the hatches in the last 6 months or so. One company that's going full steam ahead is Charles Shaw's Two Buck Chuck. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, the Bronco Wine Company, best known for its Charles Shaw Two Buck Chuck, is to launch an Australian Chardonnay in the United States under the brand name Down Under and market the wine as $3 Koala. The wine will sell at $2.99 and will be a part of a range of entry-level wines made from surplus Australian stock. The Bronco Wine Company will target Yellowtail, which retails at about $7 a bottle and has sales of 8.6 million cases a year in the United States.
A $3 Koala is the last thing the Aussies need as they desperately try and reposition themselves out of the volume end of the wine market. But being back into oversupply in Australia, the Bronco Wine Company is simply buying grapes that would otherwise be left to rot on the vine. Not a good solution for anybody. Another bad situation is swine flu in the UK. What's going on there, Jane?
Stop, you're not going to keep that in. Some of you may recall that some churches in Sydney banned wine from Holy Communion, and it's happening over here in the UK, as Catholic churches in the Diocese of Plymouth have been advised to stop serving wine. The World Health Organization has upgraded the seriousness of swine flu, and two cases were found in the city of Plymouth. The Plymouth Diocese covers almost the whole of the southwest of England, serving Cornwall, Devon and Dorset. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk to get these stories in full.
Well, if swine flu becomes really bad, people will end up staying in. I wonder how that will affect the drinking consumption in the UK. Next up, we have the spotlight. This week, it's a book review, Tom Stevenson's Wine Report, 2009. I've said in the past that I would never review an annual wine recommendation list, and thankfully, I still don't have to. Tom Stevenson's Wine Report is an excellent annual update to the wine regions of the world. It's jammed full of vintage reports and guidance on the top wineries, but the report is divided into countries and regions. Each key section is written by a regional expert. Now, while I don't pretend to know all the people Tom uses, those who I do know are eminently suited for their region, and many of them have been on our show. Each country or region has one or more articles on important issues or special interest topics, and they are in general excellent and quite varied. The report is worth its price just for the articles alone, but they also include a number of top 10 lists, often for the best or perhaps most established or even the up-and-coming producers. Some regions get lots of different top 10 ratings, and each region often don't have the same criteria for selecting their top 10. But they are an excellent guide for wineries to keep an eye on. And while most top 10 lists are pretty subjective, and there's always disagreement among wine people about what is in a top 10 list, if you use them as a guidance to try and experiment for those regions, you won't be disappointed. For a wine annual, obviously the vintage report is very important, and the wine report gives a paragraph or two on climatic conditions for most recent vintages, and a shorter description on wine styles for previous vintages. The vintage information is short, but detailed enough to give a feeling about how the vintage was and what to look for in terms of the styles of wine being produced from that region for that vintage. Perhaps the most disappointing thing about the book was the recent vintages. While whites from the Southern Hemisphere start to arrive in the UK around September 2008, no reference to these wines were made. They simply get a weather report and an indication of yields for the 2008 vintage. To me, this is understandable, given the rush to get the book published in time for the Christmas market at 2008. But it is the Northern Hemisphere wines that are the most disappointing. The earliest vintage for the 2009 book is 2007. With many white wines and some reds for 2007 available by the mid-2008, I would have expected an overview of some of the wines, but we simply get a weather patterns and yields. To me, this makes the book pretty useless if you're trying to get an idea of what's coming up based on weather reports. This tells me the book was put together probably around the beginning half of 2008, rather than the second half of 2008, and for a book that's supposed to represent 2009, it is a bit dated by the time it goes to market. Weightings on the pages of the book are also a wee bit strange. For example, Jura and Savoy receives 10 pages, while New Zealand gets 9 and California gets 7 pages. Both of those countries and regions are more significant than Jura. The weighting is out of balance, and Tom is obviously a French fan, as he has a total of 87 pages for France, 10 for Germany, 21 for Italy, 16 for Spain, 11 for Australia, the most important wine region in the UK, and 7 for Switzerland, of all things. While the book is disproportionately weighted, it's pretty consistent with a lot of UK wine writers who still today believe that if you know France, you know the world of wine, which is obviously ludicrous. However, given the book is full of detailed analysis and is positioned for the hardened wine geek and member of the trade, the weighting is probably what most people who want to buy the book would expect. Now, I've been reading and dipping into the book for over a month before writing this review, and I thought I'd lost the book while proofing for this review. Luckily, I found it. But in the 10 minutes or so that I had to hunt through the house high and low to try and find it to check some facts, and I thought it was lost, I realised that I'd be happy to go out and buy another copy. And that, to me, is a sign of an excellent book. At a recommended retail price of $9.99, I think it offers excellent value for money, and in the end, I rated this book 90 out of 100, which is a cracking rating. That ends the spotlight. Next week, we're going to be looking at oxidative versus reductive winemaking in the spotlight. Some of you guys will know all about it. Hopefully, it's a good starting point to look at some of the winemaking options that different winemakers use. Next up, we're going to give you some more clues about our mystery grape region. Now, in our mystery grape region, the vines are cultivated in 14 communes in this appellation with varying terroirs. There are three distinct areas, however. The western vineyards are on clay and limestone soils, producing quite powerful wines. From here to the hilltop town is high in gravel, giving delicate wines, while closer in, there is flint, which makes long, perfumed wines. Apart from dry white Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir is also grown, producing red and rosé wines. And while whites at their best are sublime, its popularity has meant there's also some pretty mediocre stuff out there, and at prices above 10 quid a bottle, which is ridiculous for the quality. Now, I'm going to give you the answers to the mystery wine region after our interview. This week, it's with Glenn Yaffa. He's the Executive Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Washington's Chateau St. Michel, and Mike Coveney from Hilltop Wines. Let's have a listen to what they have to say about Washington State wines. Hi, I'm here with Glenn Yaffa and Mike Coveney. How are you guys?
Fine, thanks.
Great, thank you.
Excellent. We're going to be talking about Washington State wines today, which is an interesting area. I lived in Washington for about 4 or 5 months and grew web fingers. So I'll be interested to see how you deal with the weather out there. Seattle in particular is quite wet.
I think that's most people's perception. If they know that Washington is not where the president lives, if they know the other Washington, that it's perceived to be very wet, which it is. However, our growing region is not, because it's in the rain shadow of two mountain ranges.
You mentioned people get a bit confused with it being Washington, D.C. Where is Washington State then?
Washington State is in the northwestern corner of the United States, north of California and Oregon.
And then right on the Canada border, isn't it?
Right. Vancouver is just over the border, British Columbia.
Yeah, and you've got, Victoria, isn't it?
The island of Victoria. Yeah, Victoria, very pretty place to visit as well.
Excellent. You said that the grapes aren't grown in Seattle, though. So where do you grow the grapes?
All of our grapes are grown in eastern Washington in the Columbia Valley, which gets only about 7 or 8 inches of rain a year. And it's almost like high desert there. And in many respects makes it the perfect place to grow grapes because we get to control the water as opposed to some of the issues that many vintners have with trying to predict when they should pick because of rains that are coming in the fall, et cetera.
So you dry particularly at the end of the season?
Yes, dry most of the season, but we have a very, most growers have very precision irrigation regime, so you can really focus on growing fruit as opposed to canopy. You have very well-drained soils, sandy soils. I think most of the great vineyards of the world typically are on very poor soils and very good draining soils.
You're a man who believes in treat them mean to keep them keen.
That's right. We've done a lot of experimentation over many years with some universities around the world with irrigation, so it's a pretty precise science at this point.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Would you say you're up to speed as good as the Aussies? Because they're pretty good at irrigation these days.
Well, I think we've learned a lot. I think we're pretty good. I don't know that how we would compare ourselves to the Aussies, but I think for the purposes of growing fruit in our region, it's become quite a science.
Okay, excellent.
I think one of the interesting facts about the location of Washington State is that because it's north of California, north of Oregon, and if people understand that Oregon is a cool climate region, then their expectation is that Washington is a cool climate region too. And, that's not the case given that the main grape producing region is in a semi-arid desert to the eastern side of the Cascade Mountains.
So would you say you're continental climate then?
Yeah, I think it's more of a continental climate. And, I think the thing that's kind of amazes people is we're as far north, for example, as Portland, Maine, which, is a very cold area, but also on the same latitude as Bordeaux and Burgundy, our growing region is. So we have the benefit of these long days, particularly when the grapes are growing through cell maturation during June, the height of the growing season. So we're getting about 2 hours more daylight than we would, say, in a vineyard that you'd have in Napa Valley. I think the other great thing about it is you have a longer growing season, so the fruit hangs longer and has more time to mature. And the belief is that creates greater complexity in the fruit. We also, because we harvest later than, say, you would in California, you tend to, we're at a period where we have these warm days. We could get up to 80 degrees Fahrenheit.
What's that in Celsius?
What would that be? That would be about 18, 25. Okay.
That would be about 25 degrees Celsius.
And then at night, we would get down about half of that. And so what that does is you get your sugars up during the day, but you get this great natural acidity that you preserve because of the cool evening. So we're new world, but we tend to have an old world style, if you will, because of that nice natural acid balance that we get in the wine.
We call it the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
And What grapes do you grow? I presume a bit of Pinot Noir.
Actually, no. Pinot Noir, we do grow a little bit of Pinot Noir, but it's principally a clone that's used for sparkling wine. There are some people in some cooler areas now that are growing some other clones of Pinot.
I have had Washington State Pinot, though.
Yeah, up in the Lake Chelan area.
There's a small amount of it, yeah. But that's what I was saying about Oregon is the home of the Pinot Noir, and Washington has a much broader range of varietals.
We grow just about all the classic varieties, and I think people say to us, well, why can't you be like Oregon and just focus on Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris, or why can't you be like New Zealand and just focus on Sauvignon? But a lot of the classic varieties do extremely well there. Merlot is one that ripens extremely well, much better than we would in a vineyard in California. We own vineyards in California as well. Produces, in fact, the wines can be so big and complex that you'd often taste them after Cabernets as opposed to before. We're one of our winery, Chateau Saint-Michel, for example, is the largest producer of Riesling in the world. So Riesling does very well in our climate. But grapes like Cabernet grow extremely well there. A lot of people think that's, has an incredibly bright future. In Washington State, Sauvignon grows very well there. So I think it's Syrah grows very well in Washington State because of the extremes of heat and cold.
I think it's fair to say at the moment that through the breadth of varietals that are grown in Washington, really it's the jury's still out on where the special spot is and the sweet spot is. And I think the industry is still young enough that we're still learning about where the best spots are and which are the best varietals to grow. But I think certainly from an export point of view, the understanding of Washington would be centered around Riesling, Merlot and Syrah probably at this stage. But that's not to say that the other varietals don't have a rosy future too.
That's a bizarre combination though, isn't it? Because Riesling, cool climate, you can go out in warmish climates, but usually where you grow Riesling, you don't grow Merlot. So, Merlot is normally warmer, and Cabernet Sauvignon even warmer again. I've very rarely see Riesling and Cabernet Sauvignon being grown anywhere near each other.
Well, I think if you look at the larger appellation of the Columbia Valley, you can drive, I believe it's 200 kilometers would be the equivalent in either direction, and not get to the end of it. You have just a very broad growing area and a lot of different sites and environments for growing grapes. And that's why you have just a proliferation of many different varieties that do extremely well.
Where does Washington State fit in within terms of California's number one? What's number two?
We would be number two.
You're number two.
We would be number two, albeit a distant number two. We only, we have about 32,000 acres, which would be, 15,000 hectares approximately of vineyards. So we're smaller than the Napa Valley in terms of the acreage that's planted to grapes at this point, but it's growing.
So where are you selling your wine? If you're the second largest producer in the States, is it mainly within the States? Do you export? Is it mainly within Washington? Or is Microsoft hoovering it all your wine up?
We export about 5% of our overall wine. Our company does. We're the seventh largest U.S. wine company, so we're a fairly large company, have a large domestic market. But we do export our wines to 75 countries, and we have some, I would say, fairly significant markets in the EU. Some smaller markets that would probably surprise people how much they sell. So,
which markets in the EU?
Well, we're in many of them, but a market like Denmark, Israel, is a big market for us. Switzerland, Germany. We kind of overperform, if you will, in some of those markets.
What about in the UK?
The UK has probably been slow to adopt Washington wine. I don't know whether that's down to a lack of awareness of the wines or a lack of effort and input from the winery's point of view. But certainly within San Michel, obviously they have a very broad export basis. Washington has a mix of size and scale wineries, and so as much as you have some larger wineries with the ability to export, there are also some that are less able to export. Within the UK, I see a rosy future for Washington wines. As we can grow awareness, there is a broad range of varietals available, and Washington has the ability to produce at different across different price points. And so there really is something for everybody.
As quite a big producer, what are the sort of problems that you encounter growing in Washington State?
I would say the biggest challenge we have, and it's been diminished over the last decade, is winter. Being as far north as we are, it used to be almost every 5 years you would have a winter event where it would get well below zero Fahrenheit, but it would get cold enough to kill your vines back to the ground. And so that was tough. Every time you'd sort of get your momentum going as an industry, it would slow down. I think we've learned as an industry how to mitigate that, and so that the impact of winter has been less severe. You know, we're fortunate in that we don't have the risk with phylloxera, because the soils are very sandy soils. They don't have enough clay for phylloxera to survive. You know, we are planted on our own rootstock. So some of the, you know, we don't have the issues like in California. They've been battling with a glassy-winged sharpshooter. So a lot of the pest, you know, sort of issues are not things that we've had to deal with.
Cold is great for pests.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The, you know, phylloxera does not overwinter well either. So
fantastic. Yeah. I see everything is on their own rootstock?
It is, yeah.
And with global warming, you'll be moving over to...
You have a lot of discussions around the campfire about the impact of global warming and what that means for Washington State. That probably, means it'd be very favorable at some point if they continue to have challenges growing grapes and, you know, farther south. But
do you find your yields are quite low at the moment? Because normally when you get into cool climate regions, or although you're growing Cabernet Sauvignon, which isn't normally coolish climate, you'd normally find that the yields are very, very low, and therefore profitability is hard, particularly when you compare it to maybe someone like Sonoma County, where they can grow loads of wine, loads of grapes, and at quite a cheap price.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, we don't have the equivalent of the Central Valley in California, where you can have incredible yields. Where it's certainly a better scenario than what you'd have in the coastal vineyards in Oregon, when you're struggling to get 2 tons to an acre. But we get normal yields, typically anywhere from 4 to 5 tons to an acre. On some of your higher tier wines, you'll have a little less. And actually, Riesling benefits from carrying a little heavier crop load. You can get up to 6 or 7 tons per acre. So we have enough heat to allow us to do that.
I think from a export standpoint, actually, that's an interesting point, because also I think the expectation is that perhaps because California has historically dominated the export scene, that somehow the other regions don't have the scale. Washington does have the scale to be able to sell at, you know, some relatively commercial price points. That's our job here, is to communicate that to the trade so that people understand that Washington is not a niche producer. It's not, you know, there are some small boutique, there are wineries at that end of the scale, but yeah, there are wineries also that can sell great wines at great price points and represent great value.
I'm just looking at the AVAs of Washington State, and you've got some great names like Horses Heaven Hills, Rattlesnake Hills. Obviously, Rattlesnake Hills got to be an American AVA. But AVAs are still a relatively new thing in the States, and there's still a wee bit of arguing over the AVAs, from my understanding as well. What's the current situation with AVAs in the U.S.? What does AVA stand for?
American Viticultural Area. I think in our state, the process has flowed fairly well. I think we've been able in each of these areas to gain the support and agreement of the growers and wine making community in these various areas on, you know, the scope of the appellations when these applications have been done. And I think there's been some issues that the TTB, which is our regulatory bureau, has had with approving some appellations recently, if I'm not mistaken, in Northern California, which caused the whole process to sort of be put on hold for a while they reviewed some issues related to that. But I would say the process that we've engaged in Washington has been a fairly smooth process and one that's been very cooperative amongst the growers and wineries.
One region that came up last week when we were talking about Oregon was Walla Walla Valley. It was just a bit of a joke, really. But I've noticed it's in Walla Walla Valley is in Washington State as well. Is it the same region, or is it a different region, or is the region split over multiple states?
Columbia Valley actually spills over into Oregon, and as does the Walla Walla Valley.
How do you deal with that? Because I'm thinking, in my database, I have things like by U.S. state, like Washington, California, and then within there, I have the AVAs.
Right.
Within that, how do you deal with that sort of situation?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think for us, since we don't grow grapes on either side of the state line, ours would be Walla Walla, Washington State, or Columbia Valley, Washington State.
Oh, it is specified as Walla Walla.
Yeah, Washington. We would have the state on.
Oh, okay.
On
it makes
our
it
label.
Easier.
Yeah,
then. Excellent. Is the terroir different?
You mean from both sides of?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that for example in Walla Walla it would be that different. Just crossing the state border, Walla Walla is a little bit different. Has a little bit richer soils than some of the other AVAs in the Columbia Valley, which tend to be more just pure sandy soils.
The problem is when you're looking at an AVA, the region soils and the climate, etc., is something that's created by Mother Nature, whereas the state border was something that was put down by people. So, the fact that the state line goes through the middle of it is just something decided by bureaucracy.
Following the Columbia River.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas the actual natural state of the soils and the climate is something that you can't dictate by a state boundary.
Okay, what's the future for Washington State? So we'll start with you, Glenn, and then we'll just talk about the UK situation.
I think it's incredible. I mean, I started working in the Washington wine industry 27 years ago, and we had 15 wineries, and today we have 600. And we, as a state, probably produce over 9 million, up to close to 10 million cases of wine right now. But we still don't have a global awareness of the region. So if you look at that opportunity, it's a fairly substantial growing area, selling a fairly substantial amount of wine, but yet still building awareness in our domestic market. And even though we've been attacking the international market for over 20 years, it's almost like we're just starting in many ways.
We were talking about Oregon last week, and Oregon is known for its Pinot Noir, and perhaps that's the reason why it has a higher presence in my mind than Washington State, even though you guys are much, much bigger. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I think we were talking about it earlier, we've been reluctant to sort of hang our hat on just one variety because there's so many that have been successful, not only in terms of being able to grow great quality fruit, but the ability to have them commercially accepted on a broad scale. We've had the likes of Robert Parker say that, Washington State will take its place amongst the top five Cabernet producing regions in the world and perhaps already has. So at the same time, people are saying, well, you ought to be pushing your Merlot or your Riesling or your Syrah. So I think, there's a lot of different opinions out there about what will sort of lead the way as we move forward in time.
Any comments on the UK situation?
Well, I think in the UK, we're going to be a 20-year overnight success. the wines have been available here in the past, and we've never really been able to gain traction. Many reasons for that, perhaps. But, over the last few years, we've seen steady increase in terms of the number of brands that are imported into the UK. We now have a major listing with the Co-op for one brand, Washington Hills. So I think that, American wine generally in the UK has a high profile, and I think Washington will take its place, as one of, as a widely known region, producing great quality wine at a great price point. And, I look forward to seeing there being a greater presence on the shelves.
I mentioned the drop in the pound hasn't helped, but you did for a while. The pound was quite strong against the dollar. Did you see any imports increase during that period?
We did see increases in imports, but I'm not sure that was the sole reason, because likewise, since the pound's moved, we haven't seen a great drop. So I don't see that the two are completely linked at that point. I think as the awareness grows for the region, and as people understand that, you know, Washington can produce great wine at a great price point, then, you know, rightly it will take its place on the shelves.
Okay then, guys, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That ends this week's look at the other US wine regions. I think we'll tackle California at some point, but not for a while, as next week we're going to be looking at wine auctions. I've had a few requests for interviews with wine auctions, so we're going to be talking with Stephen Mould, Senior Director and European Wine Department Manager of Sotheby's. We're going to be talking to them about the history of wine auctions from one of the world's top auction houses. And before we finish up with our quote, the mystery grape. This week, the mystery grape was Sancerre. Let me give you the clues again. Sancerre is a hilltop town on the left bank of the Upper Loire, which gives its name to one of the Loire and French's most renowned wines. It's virtually synonymous with Sauvignon Blanc, so who would have guessed that until the middle of the 20th century, the area produced red wines and whites from the Chasselas grape. It was not until white Sauvignon wines were introduced into the Parisian bistros that Sancerre began to climb to fame. The climate here is continental, but the river to the east and the forest to the west help moderate and low temperatures. Vines are cultivated in 14 communes, and this appellation has a variety of terroirs. But there are three distinct areas. The western vineyards are on clay and limestone soils, producing quite powerful wines. From here to the town of Sancerre is high in gravel and giving delicate wines, while close to Sancerre itself, there's flint, which makes long-lived perfume wines. Now, apart from dry white Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir is also grown and produces a light red and rosé wines. And while white Sancerre is at its best sublime, its popularity has meant there's also some mediocre stuff being made. Okay, that's pretty much the show for this week. Nothing more than the quote. And this week it is by an anonymous person, so I don't know who said it, but it's a pretty good one. Reality is the illusion that occurs due to a lack of wine. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.